Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Physics in Action podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Josh, and we've got a great show for you today.
Leading off, Alex discusses Lawrence Krauss's book, The Physics of Star Trek.
It's a great book review, and if we can get the scheduling down, we'll hopefully have Dr. Krauss on the show later this season.
Let's hope we can work that out. Also, Jeff provides some background information on the famous physicist Hans Bethe.
With that, let's turn it over to Alex and the Physics of Star Trek.
Hi, my name is Alex, and I'm with the Physics in Action podcast. One of the books that I read over the summer that I particularly enjoyed that had to deal with physics was a book called The Physics of Star Trek by Lawrence M. Krauss. And being a very big Star Trek fan, it obviously got my attention, and I wanted to explore more and see what the physics were behind it and see how everything worked. And I know that, you know, when you watch episodes of Star Trek, you see all sorts of technology and new and innovative ideas that aren't of reality in our world yet. But if you look and you see the inventions that are in Star Trek and how many of them have become a reality over the recent years, it's pretty cool to think that someday we might have warp drive on spaceships or something like that. Like, for example, like the communicators and stuff, you know, we have walkie talkies now. I mean, we're not that far off. So it was really cool to read about some technologies that might be a reality in our future. So some of the things in the book that especially caught my attention and that were particularly interesting for me were how Star Trek is able to travel the speed of light and also faster than the speed of light, aka warp drive. And so one of the first problems that the book wanted to deal with is the problem of inertia. And when you're trying to get to the speed of light, how do you avoid becoming a pancake in your seat because of the inertial forces on you when you accelerate to that speed? And so according to the TV show and also the book mentions, the book in Star Trek came up with what are called inertial dampeners, and which actually prevent you from becoming a victim of extreme inertia by basically moving you forward at the same rate and with the same acceleration as the ship is trying to push you backward. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And the only problem with that is that you kind of have to manipulate gravity a little bit, but it was still pretty cool to read about. And then actually going towards the speed of light, the speed of light in Star Trek is known as what is known as impulse speed. And half the speed of light is half impulse. And there, you know, you have quarter impulse and three quarter impulse and whatever you want. And according to the book, or actually according to the TV show, the Enterprise, the Starship Enterprise, or any of the other Starship fleets have fusion reactors on board, fusion technology is something that we don't currently have. It's the process of burning lighter molecules and basically mushing them into heavier molecules. And it's the process that takes place on the sun, and it's what produces the heat and the energy that keeps us alive. So, and what's better about fusion energy is that there's no radioactive byproduct from it. So it's clean and highly, highly, well, full of energy. So basically with so the Star Trek, the show, says that there's a fusion reactor on board the Enterprise or whatever ship you have that's going to make it go the speed of light or whatever impulse speed that you want. And then the book goes to explore the actual science behind the fusion technology that would have to be on board. And the book says that, you know, with some research and, you know, some data and stuff, in order for the fusion reactor to work, you have to have an abundant source of hydrogen to be able to pump into it to create the energy. And according to the book, the energy or the amount of hydrogen that you would need to produce the energy to go, say, the speed of light, you would need more hydrogen than the mass of the ship that you were flying. So already that you could start, you see some holes in the in Star Trek story. So then pretty soon the Star Trek writers for the TV show figured this out, and they said, well, what if, fine, you know, if we can't have all the hydrogen on board the ship, then we'll collect it as we go through space, because hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe. And it's floating out there in small amounts. And as we go, we'll just have a collector on the front of the ship and we'll suck it in and burn it as it comes in. But then the book looked at that and said, well, the problem with that is that hydrogen isn't in high enough concentrations in the universe to be able to suck it in efficient amounts. So basically what would happen is, yeah, you'd be sucking some in through a collector, but you wouldn't be sucking in nearly enough. And in order to collect the amount of hydrogen that you would need to be able to propel you to the speed of light or whatever, you would need a collection screen that was 27 miles long. So, or 27 miles wide, it might be more accurate. But so obviously the reality of using a fusion reactor for going the speed of light on something, say, the size of the Enterprise would be pretty slim due to the methods and modes that you would need to be able to carry the hydrogen that you would need with you to produce the energy. So I thought it was just really interesting to just kind of see that and how that works. So as I was reading, now I'm all disappointed that we're not going the speed of light. And that's, you know, especially once you look at the hydrogen situation, and of course you have Einstein to consider. But then the book went and discussed how warp drive might be possible. And warp drive, for those who aren't familiar, is the process of going faster than the speed of light. And actually, going faster than the speed of light. And so one, the book and Lawrence M. Krauss basically looked and saw and investigated how warp drive might actually be possible. And one of the theories in the book, which I thought was really cool, is you actually warp the space around you and create an immense gravitational field around the ship. So that what happens is that, as we know from previous scientific research, gravity has the ability to bend light. And basically one of the theories that the book investigates is that if you create an immense amount of gravity around you or the vessel that you're in, you'll actually bend the light around the ship. So Einstein and all these other theories said you can't travel faster than the speed of light. But what would happen if you were able to bend light as you went, so that as you were traveling, the light around you was going the same speed as you, and outside that little gravitational bubble, you were going much, much faster than the speed of light. So technically, you're not going faster than the speed of light, but you really are. So this whole process is what is basically warping space-time. That's how they, you know, that's where the name warp drive came from, was the process of warping time and space in order to accomplish this. And I was reading this and I was totally just amazed at just the possibilities of doing something like that. And then the same theory, the book and Star Trek, and the same theory was then applied to things like deflector shields and tractor beams and all about how to warp space. You know, if you can create enough gravity in front of the ship so that a phaser blast, the beams from that get deflected around the ship because of a gravitational field, you're not going to get hit. Hence a deflector shield and a tractor beam. You know, if you warp the fabric of space, let's say you wanted to use your tractor beam to move a planet. If you were to open up the fabric of space in front of the planet and pinch it off behind the planet, then the planet would actually move toward the ship and with the tractor beam. So using this sort of warp technology to literally warp space, the fabric of space, was really cool. And I'm sure there would be some consequences of warping the fabric of space, but I'd rather look at the positives and be an optimist and say, yeah, this is really awesome. So, and one of the last things I thought was really cool was the physics behind the transporter and how the transporter would actually have to break you apart atom by atom and move you. And there's a couple of theories about how the transporter would work. Either it breaks you apart atom by atom and moves those atoms, or it literally just takes the information about your body, essentially like reading your body in binary code and transferring that information and then recreating it somewhere else, which is just totally mind-blowing, or both. Either your body reads, puts you basically in the binary code, moves you to one place, reassembles you, and then adds the matter afterward, which would be insane. But now all sorts of questions come up, like, well, if you have a soul and no body, and how does that work? And how can you be alive and not have your body at the instant that you're being transported? And all sorts of like really kind of perplexing moral questions come about from that. And one other thing that they went to explore with the transporters, and in a couple episodes, some people have actually been replicated in the transporter. But as Mr. Krause believes in one of his theories of the physics of Star Trek, is that that would be totally impossible, because if you're starting with a certain number of atoms in the human body, there's no way that you could double that number by creating two bodies in the end. And so replication would be totally impossible, because you'd have to make essentially enough matter from nothing in order to create another person. And and that person would have to have all the same memories, the same exact personality. I mean, it would be beyond cloning in terms of replication. So the odds of that are pretty slim. But so these were just a few of the awesome things that were in The Physics of Star Trek by Lawrence M. Krause. I thoroughly enjoyed reading the book, and it was definitely worth the read over the summer, and I highly recommend it to anybody out there who's a Trekker and is really, really interested about some of the physics of the future and the technology that might be possible. So I hope you go out and you look into it and you read into it, and I hope you enjoy.
Thanks, Alex. Next up, we have Jeff and his look at the physics contributions of Hans Bethe.
Hi, I'm Jeff, and I'm doing a podcast part on Hans Bethe. Hans Bethe, born July 2nd, 1906, died March 6, 2005, was a German-American physicist and Nobel laureate in physics for his work on the theory of stellar nucleosynthesis. A versatile theorist physicist, Bethe also made important contributions to quantum electrodynamics, nuclear physics, solid-state physics, and particle acceleration. During World War II, he was head of the theoretical division at the secret Los Alamos Laboratory developing the first atomic bomb. There, he played a key role in calculating the critical mass of the weapons, and he also did theoretical work on the implosion method used in the Trinity test and the Fat Man weapon drop on Nagasaki, Japan. For most of his career, Bethe was a professor at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. During the 1950s, Bethe also played an important role in the development of the larger hydrogen bomb. Though he had originally joined the project with the hope of proving it could not be made, Bethe later campaigned together with Albert Einstein and the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists against nuclear testing in the nuclear arms race. He influenced the White House to sign the ban of nuclear tests in 1963, and he also was influential in the 1972 SALT I Treaty. His scientific research never ceased even to his later years of life. He is one of the few scientists who can claim a major paper in his field every decade of his career, which spanned nearly 60 years. Freeman Dyson called Bethe the supreme problem solver of the 20th century.
Thanks, Jeff. That about wraps up this episode of Physics in Action Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. Write to us at physicsinactionpodcast@gmail.com, or you really, really love feedback on our iTunes page. Just search for Physics in Action.
And you can always leave us a comment on our webpage at www.physicsinaction.com. Don't forget, we help support our efforts by starting your Amazon.com shopping from our webpage by clicking on the Amazon.com link on the right.
Thanks to Jeff Myers from and For Me to See for the intro and exit music tech. Music is brought to you courtesy of Mevo's Music Alley. Check it out at music.mevo.com.